Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club and Week to Week, our news and political roundtable discussion program for this Monday, March 4th. I'm glad you could join us. I'm John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial here at the Commonwealth Club, and I'm very pleased to be your host for tonight's program. By the way, if you are the type of person who is interested in federal budget sequester and fiscal cliffs and the like, you'll want to be back here in a month when we have Mr. No New Taxes himself, Grover Norquist, addressing the Commonwealth Club. So that program is Thursday, April 4th, right here in San Francisco. And on Monday, April 15th, we'll be back here for the next week-to-week program, and we can talk all about Grover. So it'll be great. As always in our program, we'll be discussing some of the top most important events of the past week or two. And just let me note that, of course, any comments, any opinions we express are just those of the speakers, not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, its members, or its supporters. So let me introduce our great panel today. Right next to me is Carly Schwartz. She's the founding editor of Huffington Post San Francisco. And before joining Huffington Post, she ran new media efforts for Jerry Brown's successful gubernatorial campaign. You can follow her work at the Post on Twitter. Their handle is HuffPostSF. Next to her is Dr. Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's also the political analyst at NBC 11. He's the author of a whole bucket full of books, but his most recent tome is this one, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. It has a happy ending.
Should I just leave now?
Yes. Harry Potter saves them all. And on the end, we're very happy to welcome to our week-to-week stage for the first time Melissa Griffin, a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, political analyst on the Mornings with Melissa on CBS 5, and a contributor to San Francisco Magazine. Her Twitter handle is SFEX_Griffin. So there are question cards on your chairs. Please write down and submit your questions. We'll get to as many of them as we can. I'll try to work some of them into our discussion, but we'll also devote the part of the second half of the program to just directly answering your questions. And then at the end of the program, we're going to pick two contestants to come up here and take our news quiz. We'll pit you against each other. So first prize is a genuine bottle of Two Buck Chuck. It's not Two Buck Chuck anymore. It's $2.49 Buck Chuck. So it's an investment, folks.
Candle.
Yes.
Worth every penny.
But first, let's get to the news of the week. And we're not going to discuss the Pope, so the only other biggest issue to dive right into is the sequester. We can discuss the Pope if you want. But first, sequester, what does that mean to the Pope? No. This past Friday, of course, President Barack Obama signed the order to begin $85 billion in budget cuts that are mandated by the sequestration agreement that he and the Republicans agreed to in 2011. So I noticed the little informal survey we took out there. It looked like a majority of folks said, yes, they felt they were going to be affected by the sequester, or knew either they or someone they knew was being affected by the sequester. So let's talk about what happened, what's going to happen maybe. And maybe I'll start with Mayor Bloomberg from New York, who said, calm down, folks. It's not that big of a deal. We'll get through it. Larry, let's start with you. Is Mayor Bloomberg correct that it's not the hyper disaster it's been portrayed to be?
We in California know all about earthquakes, right? There's that sudden jolt, you know, that comes out of nowhere. And then there's that kind of rolling thing that goes on for 20 seconds, you know, and you wonder if it'll ever stop. I'd say this is in the second category. There's no sudden jolt here, but it's going to roll for a while, and people will feel it downstream. You're talking 2.3% of the budget. That's not a lot of money. I mean, $85 billion, I could use it myself, but it's not a lot of money, okay, in the context of the budget. So the issue here is not the money itself or the 2.3%. The issue is really the way it's been done, indiscriminately. And frankly, left out are probably two of the biggest spending areas that we need to look at somewhere, somehow, and that's Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, it's a botched job. I think we'll get a lot more information as we get to March 27th, which is the day that they must pass what they call the continuing resolution to keep the government going. We lunge from CR to CR these days. And I think at that time there may be an opportunity for everybody to assess what's happened, how they manage it, how they go forward, if they can put together a grand bargain, a mini bargain, any bargain, whatever.
Melissa, what do you?
You know, I don't really want to hear from a billionaire like, "Don't worry, guys, everything's going to be fine." Yeah, Michael, everything's fine in your world. I appreciate that. But his whole justification was, "We're so in debt that we can borrow all the money we want, and no one will ever stop lending us money." Because, and he gave this whole, you know, the old adage that when, you know, if you owe the bank $50,000, the bank owns you. If you owe the bank $50 million, you own the bank. And that's just not very reassuring. I gotta be perfectly honest. If that's really your justification.
Yeah.
Actually, to your point about the earthquake, another sort of metaphor that I've heard that I think makes a lot of sense, especially to us Californians, is that this is more like a Prop 13. This is something that when it gets passed initially, Democrats are going, "Oh my God, the sky is falling." And people went, "Look, everybody, you know, the sun rose the next day, it was totally fine." But over time, it created, you know, it backed up and backed up and backed up until we needed a big correction in the form of things like Proposition 30. So do I think, is, you know, the sky going to fall? Probably not, to your point, where it's going to be a little slower. But over time, I think we will see the effects of this. We don't know what they are at the present, how people are exactly going to go about cutting. But over time, we're going to see the effects.
I think one of the problems is that folks aren't going to be able to attribute, you know, long delays at the airport to, "Oh, the sequester, I'm going to get angry and, you know, try to do something about it." I mean, they're going to be so gradual that you know, it's not going to be, it's just, it seems like yet another example of Congress's inability to kind of function. And I at least from covering politics, from a, you know, media perspective, it just seems like we're constantly jumping from one crisis in Congress to the next when it comes to how to fund our government. And we'll see it again at the end of the month, and we'll see it in May with the debt ceiling fight. And it just seems like another example of a lack of concrete and, you know, effective solutions.
Yeah, and that's not about to go away. And it's not going to go away in 2014. You talk now about the Democrats winning that Congress. Yeah, not going to happen.
Do you think it ever could go away? I mean, what needs to happen so that it goes away?
Well, that's a good question. Sometimes sometimes things just don't go away, and I'm not so sure it's going to go away for a long time. I think this whole presidency, the next 4 years, is likely to be under duress this way simply because of the tension. Just if I could for a second, the biggest problem we have in terms of changing the makeup of Congress has to do with the way those districts are made up. Mm-hmm. 50% of the House districts are made up by independent commissions, as we have in California now, and they're fairly straightforward. 10% are made up in states where the Democrats controlled. 40% are made up, gerrymandered, in Republican states. Well, you're not about to lose those people, so it means winning over so many others, it's almost impossible. That's why I think this could go on for a long time.
Well, I think that there's an argument to be made. I mean, Democrats, I think, are going to want to try and backfill some of these cuts and say, if we're losing our funding for pre-kindergarten, which is, I think, something that the White House has said might happen in California, that we'll pass parcel taxes or we'll pass sales taxes, and local governments will try to fix these things. And I was talking with a group of friends the other day, and one of them said, why do Democrats want to stop the pain? They need to let people feel it and feel it quickly, and maybe that will then prompt people to make that connection between the horrible experience at the airport and what our politicians are doing, and make them be more active instead of actually trying to lessen it and soften the blow as much as possible. Let's just rip the Band-Aid off and say, this is it, people. This is what happens when you have, you know, districts that are drawn this way, and we've got to win over additional people that are, you know, maybe a supermajority of people in certain states that are gerrymandered this way.
I mean, there are some folks who are feeling fairly immediate effects of this. I mean, are we talking about like military families, some government contractors, folks who are being furloughed a certain number of days every month or whatever.
Yeah, the irony is that the states that are really going to suffer the most, Texas, South Carolina, Florida, and a few others, because of the military presence, and a couple of others, are the ones where their Republican members of Congress were most intent on allowing this to go through. So there's an irony there. It's sort of like the thing with health care, where the states that have the poorest people are the ones that are not going along with the health exchanges.
Now, the GOP is disavowing the sequester, kind of like a senator disavowing a love child. But it's a natural comparison. But doesn't this, to some effect, I mean, it, to some degree, accomplish some of what the Tea Party wing, at least, has been saying, which is, look, we've got to slam the brakes on. And, yeah, it's going to hurt, but, like you said, kind of from their point of view, rip the Band-Aid off. We've got to do this in order to get the budget back into shape. So there probably are some people in Washington, D.C. who really just aren't too upset.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
cuts,
my understanding, are just blanket across the board. They're not sort of strategically allocated towards.
Exactly.
And there may be a win in the short term, because they go, look, we cut $85 billion and nobody even noticed. So clearly there's a lot of fat that can be trimmed and you guys will figure it out. And this is a really good thing. Maybe we can cut other things as well. But I think in the long term, and we will see the effects long term, but I think there's a short term victory to be had there. I mean, I'm not sure, for the deficit hawks, how helpful it is to, keep taxes down and cut spending so you're not getting any net gain on either side. But but I think for now that there is going to be a little bit of a victory for these groups who say, look, we cut, you didn't notice, you're fine.
Now, if you've been following the what I think of as the sideshow to the sideshow, which is journalist Bob Woodward kind of sparring with a White House aide, Gene Sperling, about whether or not the White House was threatening Woodward, because Woodward had said that Obama had come up with the sequester idea, or just that he had supported it. Well, we don't even need to solve that, except for the point of how much is Obama responsible for this? I mean, the Republicans like to walk around and say, he's not leading, but this was the agreement he and the congressional Republicans made.
I don't think that you started it. I'm the youngest of six, and anyone who's been in a backhoe station wagon on a road trip knows the you started it defense is not very helpful, right? If you, who hit hardest is usually the thing. So that fight that went on was just so tiring. But the notion of sort of who's to blame is I think, somewhat of an important question. Having said that, at the end of the last fiscal cliff negotiation, so this is, if you guys remember, we're two crises ago, so this is back in January, at the end of that, the White House got their taxes on the people making more than $400,000 a year, and at that point, it's not clear that Obama was clear that we're still going to be talking about revenue. At the end of that, Boehner was like, we're done. That's all we're going to talk about in terms of revenue. We've had a revenue discussion. You got what you wanted. We're not going to talk about this anymore. And the Obama administration was like, wait. We're going to have to come back and discuss this again in another month or two. And for some reason, that wasn't made clear, or somebody's lying. I know, weird. That there was some kind of miscommunication there, where one party came away saying, this is all we're going to have to give, and the other party saying, no, this is enough to get us through, and we're going to have to come back to it.
I think it's a matter of perception. I mean, the Democrats perceive this as a step in moving along, that regardless of anything else, the tax cuts had to end. Okay, time now to end it. So this is the best way we can do it, so be it. Had nothing to do with the big picture, of the balanced approach, as they like to call it, okay? And the Republicans have said, again, perception, okay, you've got the money. You're not getting any more. I think they both are right that way. They have different ways of looking at it, and that's part of the story. You're never going to change the way they look at it. The only thing you can hope to is that there's enough hurt and anger out there that they'll be forced to come to some sort of agreement.
So we're now hoping that people will be hurt and angry.
Yeah.
And in fairness, he did have a plan. I mean, Obama's office did come up with a plan that I could read and learn about. And at the end of the day, Congress said no, but they didn't offer any alternatives. That said, they're vehemently against a government shutdown if the Sunday talk shows are any indication of the future.
But Speaker Boehner said, no, we've passed plans in the House. On at least two occasions, we've passed budgets. We've passed budgets that would cut dramatically, you know, because the biggest problem we have is spending. So each side has got their plan, you know, and the other side will say everything they can to say they don't have it. Well, they do. Obama's got a plan. The Republicans have a plan. But you know, it's sort of like the way they try to get higher ground by dismissing the existence of a plan on the other side. No, there are plans. Enough plans there to build a city.
I couldn't find a plan in response to Obama's plan, but maybe we're too many plans down the road.
Plan.com.
Yes. Well, just quickly before we move on to the next topic, do you think we're going to see a government shutdown, or do you think they'll avoid that fight?
No. You're not going to see government
Larry says no.
I think we're going to be live blogging it up to the very last second. I think we're going to see a lot of unslept nights from the HuffPost politics team, but I don't think the government
will shut down. You're not going to see a government shutdown because, among other things, Boehner's already said that he will work not to shut down the government. Now, the devil's in the details, right? Because when the Republicans pass their continuing resolution, they're going to pass it at the same rate of this $85 billion sequestration. The Democrats are going to scream about that. And so the question is, will they be able to find some middle ground, you know, to have enough funding, but not nearly as much funding as people had thought? So I just think it'd be deadly. No, the Republicans can't do it.
I think both parties right now can claim a little bit of victory. In a government shutdown, there's just, you know, to your point, I mean, how much more cynicism can we take?
Yeah.
You know, there's just nothing more, you know, that communicates ineptitude like a shutdown. I think that even today, I know they're in single digits of approval ratings right now, but no one wants to go any lower and actually have their own moms calling them up and saying, you're doing a really bad job. So they're trying to, like, maintain, like, a very basic level.
I'm not sure how Mrs. Boehner's voting. Let me tell you.
Okay, well, I've got an issue that, surprisingly, both parties seem to be coming together on, and it's an issue that not too long ago they were at each other's throats on, and that is Republicans and same-sex marriage. I mean, in 2004, this was a hot-button issue. There's some question as to whether or not it actually influenced the election, but people can argue about that. These days we're seeing Clint Eastwood, David Frum, Christine Todd Whitman, and about 130 other prominent Republicans publicly urging the Supreme Court to allow same-sex marriage. So I present to you folks, is same-sex marriage, is that a dead issue as far as our seemingly never-ending culture wars? Larry?
Oh, gosh. First of all, I'm not too excited about that 130 people. It's a very illustrious group, no question about that. But last I saw, only two were in Congress.
That's true.
Okay, so isn't it brave of these ex-governors and ex-everything else to say, I'm for it, you know? Oh, congratulations. We have two issues here, and it gets kind of thorny. The Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, and whether a state like California, how that proposition should be upheld. And the two have been sort of like merged, and they really shouldn't be in terms of deciding these cases and what they mean. Mm-hmm. If the court upholds the Defense of Marriage Act, then it causes problems for states like California. I don't see the court overturning. I've got a problem with this. I don't see the court overturning Prop 8. I don't see it. Because every time a state has passed a law on gay marriage, whether it is permitting it or denying it, the court has upheld that state. They view it as a state's rights issue. Mm-hmm. And so I hear.
Do you even think with the Obama support?
That's one more reason for them not to.
Yeah.
You know, there's no love lost there between the court majority. I mean, everybody's looking to Roberts, you know, and I think that was a one-time stand. By Roberts, for other reasons. I don't know.
So I was in Sacramento this past weekend at the California State Republican Convention. And while I was there, I hung out with the Log Cabin Republicans, because they have the best parties. And I was chatting with the president of the state Log Cabin Republicans, and I said, aren't you excited? You guys must be happy. You've got this, you know, this cool new thing that some Republicans just did. You must be thrilled. And he said something similar. He said, you know, I'm happy to see it, but frankly, these people are all ex-something or other. He's like, nobody has run as a Republican in a campaign and had this stance yet. He's like, I'll be impressed when I see that. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there were a couple of forums, panels that were out there, and there is a strand, a small, I hesitate to even put a percentage on it, but they're concentrated in like the Los Angeles area and the Bay Area of delegates who were there, who were saying, who were more of a libertarian stripe, who were saying, look, let's just take these social issues off the platform. Let's just focus on economic liberty, free trade, the ability to live your life, and just get rid of or abbreviate these things about, you know, all these things about we got to overturn Roe v. Wade and we got to prevent gay marriage and blah, blah, blah. There is a small group. Again, they are not the biggest group. And I even asked one of the log cabin Republicans, do people still single, is this still a single issue for people? Or have people kind of moved on and they're really voting based on other beliefs and this is just kind of one of them? Mm-hmm. And they said, no, there are people who were at the convention for whom that was really like the issue, their single issue that they voted on. Again, I hesitate to ascribe percentages, but my point is there's a voice that's there. Whether, you know, whether or not it's a 5-year or 10-year thing, I don't know, but it's sort of steadily growing within the party. The younger people especially are far more toward the libertarian bent who really just say economic freedom, personal freedom, get out of my bedroom.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every Republican I know, which is, I can probably count them on this hand in San Francisco,
and have a lot of fingers left.
Yeah. Just throws away the social issue. It's all about money for them and their own personal gains. And, you know, I mean, I think just growing up in our society and being young, you meet people, you know, in middle school who come out of the closet, and it's just such a natural part of young people's lives, and it'll only continue to shift. It almost seems like it's going to become a civil rights issue.
Yep, it
to
is.
Me. It's sort of paralleling the racial integration stuff of the...
But moving much faster than
it is, and the day's coming. I mean, 9 states now, plus D.C., mm-hmm. And you can see the momentum building. The whole Northeast, pretty much, has adopted gay marriage as a right, and I think you will see California will vote on it the next time. If they do, it'll pass.
Absolutely,
it'll
probably,
pass.
Probably
latest field poll showed it winning by a huge margin.
It was 2-1 in the latest field poll.
So I mean, I think, but I mean, states like, you know, Arkansas and Tennessee and...
Well, an interesting stat I read earlier this week in Harper's, and I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it because it was a really good one, was that Northerners were more likely to support racial integration than Southerners by a 2.6 margin in 1963, and when they're polled on the same issue today on gay marriage, it's only a 1.5 margin. So the South is shifting, too. I mean, those states have young people, and those young people, you know...
Even among younger evangelical Christians, it's not an issue.
Back off.
So yeah, I think you're right. It's.
And if you think about it, I mean, the Tea Partiers are funded by people like the Koch brothers who don't care about gay marriage at all.
I wanted to bring that up. I mean, the Tea Party, occasionally people will defend it and saying, look, their focus is economic. If you watch some of the theatrics, you get the social stuff thrown in there. Do you all agree? I mean, is their ascendancy kind of a further kind of pushing down of the social agenda?
They've gone off the reservation on more than one occasion. I'm sorry, I would take issue with that. Mm-hmm. I can remember vividly Tea Party folks question. They were like this with the birther movement, you know, hook, line, and sinker. They were all part of that. You know, wondering about Obama's birth, where he came from. So I think that there's a tendency of some of them, at least, to wander off of that. But you're right, when they stay with the economic issue and just the economic issue, all these other social issues go away. And they can focus more and they can get more attention.
And that's where their money's coming from. They're not being bankrolled by the National Organization for Marriage.
No.
So far as we know.
Okay. Well, another social issue, one that isn't moving maybe as fast as that one, but still has had some dramatic stuff happening, and that is drug policy. As we actually discussed last time we met, you know, we saw in November, 2 states, Colorado and Washington State, legalized recreational use of marijuana. And President Obama, soon after the election, said, look, I've got bigger fish to fry than go around shutting down medical marijuana outfits. Carly, you recently reported on a case involving Oakland's Harborside Health Center and some of their recent court setbacks. What are you seeing happening on the legal front here, at least for the Bay Area?
Well, it's just so interesting to me because it seems like the U.S. attorneys and, by extension, the Obama administration is so ready to continue cracking down on these medical operations throughout California. But when it comes to Colorado and Washington, they haven't said anything publicly. They haven't lifted a finger. They're letting the wheels turn for you know, marijuana to be legalized recreationally on a large scale. But these cases are moving ahead in the Bay Area, and it's costing money and time. And
is that kind
and
of at the whim of the U.S. attorney who kind of...
It seems to be. And Melinda Haig is the U.S. attorney for Northern California who's been the most kind of demonized in the fight against you know, medical marijuana in California. You'll see the protesters with Cruella de Vil signs on her face and just torturing the poor woman's office in downtown San Francisco. But she, yeah, it does seem to be at her kind of whim and overarchingly at the, you know, California U.S. attorney's whim. But it's coming down from the Department of Justice. I mean, this is a mandate. We've got, you know, Gil Kerlikowske, the country's drug czar, saying on the one hand that it's time to have a serious conversation about marijuana, and on the other hand saying that medical marijuana has no proven scientific value and that it's still very much an illegal drug and not making any movement to change, you know, its scheduling.
How it's classified.
How it's classified, exactly. So I don't know. It's interesting. There are a lot of moving pieces and a lot of conflicting moving pieces. I know that Harborside's a really interesting example because
And do you want to briefly explain what happened at Harborside?
Sure. So Harborside is billed as kind of the largest pot shop on the planet. It's massive. It's basically a medical marijuana emporium in Oakland. And they were faced with an injunction to close simply because on the grounds that they've grown too large. And they're fighting to stay open, and they've got, you know, patients rallying to keep them open and your regular run-of-the-mill, you know, marijuana activists fighting to keep them open. And the city of Oakland recently joined officially wanted to defend the right to keep them open, and that was the last legal setback I wrote about, and that the court ruled that a city cannot go to bat for something that's out of their jurisdiction. The city of Oakland doesn't control Harborside and therefore can't, you know, publicly fight for it. But, you know, the cases are rolling along, and it gets to stay open in the meantime, which was a big victory.
I do think it's interesting in talking about this in the context of social issues and whether or not they're shifting right now in the post-election period. I mentioned David Frum, who has become a very vocal supporter of gay marriage. He's George W. Bush's former speechwriter. I think did he coin the axis of evil phrase? Does anyone know? Am I spreading misinformation? It would be appropriate. But on the other hand, when it comes to drug legalization, he has been very vocal in saying, no, I don't feel comfortable with it.
Well, yeah, there's always been a libertarian wing of the Republican Party that you know wants this issue hands off, and who have said, you know, for crying out loud, once we legalize it or decriminalize it, whatever word you want to use, there's a difference, I know. Tax it, okay? And that solves a lot of problems from their perspective. it solves the problem of you know the conflict. It ends it. It solves the problem of cost. The cost will go down, and it also probably makes it a lot harder for criminal elements to do business because they won't be able to be, you know, manufacturing and selling it the way they do. So I mean, geez, you know, there's a lot of good things they say that come out of it. Now you've got folks fighting it for a lot of reasons, but I kind of put this in the gay marriage bucket. I think this is an issue that over time, I don't know if I'll live to see it, but over time you will see. Certainly the decriminalization, if not legalization of it. It's just rampant, which is one of the reasons why the Obama administration is caught. They're really caught on this one.
Well, here's a fun fact to your point of you know, drug operations losing money when it's legalized, you know, and in the United States. According to my friends over at the Harper's Index, the annual
revenue. You like doing that story.
I do. No, I just love the Harper's Index. They've got so many fun little facts and figures. You guys should all totally check it out. But just with Colorado and Washington, just with legalizing marijuana for recreational use in Colorado and Washington, guess how much money Mexican drug cartels stand to lose annually? Just throw out
probably
a figure.
$500
million? $1.4 billion. Just from two states that aren't even border states that already had medical marijuana programs in place, just from simply making the shift to recreational use. Imagine if all 50 states, I mean, went to medical marijuana. It's really, the figures are staggering.
Melissa, were there any...
It's the patriotic thing to do.
It's totally the patriotic thing to do.
Right.
Well, it's actually on that point. So the GOP has even come around, and Congressman McCarthy was asked this weekend what his thoughts are on medical marijuana, because to your point, there are these libertarians. And he said, look, it's something we're considering. It's something we're looking into. And that's a big departure for such a high-profile Republican. Now, we can see that the arc of history is sort of going in this direction. And if I was Eric Holder, and I think about this, if I was Eric Holder, I would procrastinate this as long as I possibly could, right? I don't want to issue the directive of what my agents are going to do on this. And here's why. Because as long as these states are able to operate this way, we're gathering more data. We're basically letting them make themselves into a science experiment for us. And so other states can look there and say, did it actually increase crime? Did it actually increase other kinds of drug use? And, you know, use that data in ways that may be productive for other states. And it's not, you know, it's a very cynical view of things, but frankly, I'm not surprised that Eric Holder's office hasn't really rushed to jump into this when I think there are a lot of people in this country who want to see how this plays out and continue to use that to inform the decisions that we make as a state like California, who's clearly going to do this soon. How do we tax it? How do we collect it? How do we regulate it? Those are lessons that we can learn from these other states. And I think that the administration, while they see that that's where it's going, are saying, let's just take our hands off for a little while and see how it plays out.
I think one of the biggest problems in California, though, is that we don't have a standard set of statewide regulations for mm-hmm. medical marijuana. We leave that up to the cities. So you have places like Los Angeles that have become the poster child for shutting down these medical marijuana operations because they're operating, you know, five per block and just, you know, no security. And then you've got San Francisco, which, you know, has a very strong set of regulations in place. But, you know, people like Melinda Haig can say, well, it's a war zone in Los Angeles, so these need to be shut down. Here's why. And places like Colorado, and I'm not sure about Washington, but I know Colorado did have a really solid set of kind of state regulations in place, and that's what allowed them to kind of make the final push towards recreational. So I agree with you, it's a cynical point of view, but it's sad if they're leaving it up to the states because to kind of serve as the example, because we sort of haven't been the model example.
Well, I don't know if I'd... Do you want the federal government to be the model example right now of anything?
No, I mean...
Yeah, Colorado might be the best we can do.
I just should be legal. I'll get on the stage and say it. But.
Well, at some point, you know, the Supreme Court has upheld twice that Congress has the right to regulate through the FDA what is and what is not an illegal substance. So, I mean, I think it will take more than just a directive from the Attorney General. You know, that's going to wind up again at the court.
Well, he said leave it to the states, and then he walked back on that. So
it's a tough issue right now, and you're right. Every state's got a different way of handling it. We're not handling it all. Medical marijuana, let's be honest, is a joke. I mean, it's a joke. I mean, come on. I need to get better. You know, here's my $49, and here's your card. I mean, you know, it's just, I know so many people who are sick. It's not funny.
Right.
I happen to think that there probably are some benefits from what I've read about.
Well, it's a joke, but it's not a joke for actual cancer patients
that's
who are
right.
getting
that's,
the medicine. And those people are just
exactly,
as abundant at those rallies as the people with back pain.
There are people who claim benefit. I think they've had it. I mean, had benefit. And but this is a big one in terms of the federalism issues, you know, until they work through that.
Ugh. Our friend Gavin made the rounds on all the big late-night talk shows last week, claiming over and over again that any lawmaker you talk to behind closed doors supports marijuana legalization. And I don't know how true that is, but supposedly.
Well, let's try to get through two more quick topics before we start going through your questions. Immigration reform, another big thing. We are seeing a push in Congress on this to try to come to grips with, 11, 12 million undocumented immigrants, what to do about border control, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This will be resolved. I know.
It will? Is that an optimistic?
That's hard to believe.
From the man who wrote The Rise and Fall of California. That's optimism.
There's a ray of sunshine there.
What is that?
This will get resolved simply because Republicans are starting to see the light. You know, they've been in this dark room, you know, thinking that they could win by collecting every single old white guy around, you know, and there aren't enough, and the numbers are diminishing, and you know, they get it, some of them, that, you know, if they get on board with immigration reform, come up with a way for someone to gain citizenship after they've paid their taxes and wait their turn in line and all that kind of stuff, and of course secure the borders, that it may pay off. I mean, you know, when you get 29% of the Latino vote of what is now the largest minority in the country, whose members are voting in larger and larger percentages as they are seated here, second, third, fourth generation, this is suicide to ignore that group and count on the others. And they didn't do so well with anybody else. They didn't do well with Asian Americans. They didn't do well with African Americans. They didn't do well with gays. They didn't do well with young people. They didn't do well with women. Who's left?
People like you, Larry.
That's it. That's it. I'm getting calls every day.
You know, it's interesting. You watch, if you look at the, if you go back and, because I'm sure this will sound fascinating to you. If you go back and look at the primary debates for the 2012 elections or even the 2008 elections, and you see the stances that the Republicans are taking on this issue. Right now, when you have Republicans, even Jeb Bush saying, we want to have a legal residency, maybe not citizenship, we'll have a residency legalization plan. I mean, you would have, you know, gotten drummed off the stage during those primary debates. It's a huge 180, and I hate to keep talking about this weekend. It was really awesome. So it was, I mean, the 180 that they have done on this, let me tell you. At the convention, it was like the big event. There was like a mariachi band there. They had, I swear, they had this one speaker from this organization called Grow California, and they go in and they find grassroots. They find Hispanic and Latino leaders who are already in communities, and they groom them to be Republicans and run for even nonpartisan office. Hey.
Yes.
Whatever. Go where the people are, right? So this guy, he's the president of this organization, he gets up and he's talking about how the Republicans have a long road back, and he's going with the elephant metaphor. And so he goes, we're going to tackle this like, you know, you never heard that whole thing about how you eat an elephant? And the whole room's like, one bite at a time. And he goes, and it tastes better with salsa. And we were like, oh, that's the noise. It was like, oh, what? Oh, that was like, oh, weird. Oh, that was, I'm uncomfortable. But it was just like, that's... It was just throughout the whole weekend we were there. So it is like, not that you expect them to play hard to get with the Latino vote, but wow, it was really amazing. So they are full speed ahead. They know this is an issue. You can see it in the shift of the stance from self deportation to, all right, let's find a way to deal with people who were brought here before they were, you know, old enough to vote, and, you know, with parents who brought them here, and the dreamers, basically. So I think that there's definitely a shift, and to your point, it's necessary. There has to be, and I'll tell you right now, again, they are embracing it. Oh, one more thing. So I asked the head of the media organization, this guy, Mike Standiff, we asked what would be, if the Republicans had like an official drink of the Republican Party, what would it be? What would be your cocktail? And he was like, a margarita. I was like, you're just, come on.
A margarita with tequila.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, you know, again, they're clearly trying very hard to embrace this group of people. They think that because they have Catholic tendencies, et cetera, that they've got a good shot.
Well, there's an opportunity here, for crying out loud. I mean, I don't know how many times I have to hit their head against the wall. There's an opportunity, particularly when it comes to social issues. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get to religious issues, when you get to the abortion question. I mean, when you get to all these types of questions that conservative Catholics feel very strongly about, you know, and Latinos are almost disproportionately, let's put it that way, Catholic. My goodness, if they use their heads, you know, they could really bond with a lot of these people and start making some inroads. They have to start thinking beyond old white guys. I'm tired of the phone calls.
And if you look down to the nitty-gritty, I mean, the reform that the president's trying to pass is not that revolutionary. I mean, I read one analyst say that it was you know, harsher than Reagan's plan.
It is.
13 years to full citizenship versus his was
right.
half
13
that.
13 years?
I think it was six.
Wow.
After all is said and done.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, then let's move into our last topic. Carly's former boss, Jerry Brown.
One of the stranger bosses I've had, in a great way.
Well, after the November elections, when, of course, he got his Proposition 30 passed, that was the education funding bill, a referendum, and there were a number of reports in the national media kind of showing Jerry Brown, he's, you know, riding a surge of renewal in California, and the budget prospects are looking better, and et cetera, et cetera. He's well situated for reelection. That's what the stories were basically saying. What do you folks think? I mean, how is he doing with navigating both now that he won that election? What does he pivot to deal with next? Larry, do you have any ideas?
Well, we got to see how the budget works out. I mean, he's got a legislature that with a sometimes two-thirds and sometimes not two-thirds majority, depending upon the day or resignation of the week. But you know, it looks like those vacancies will work to his favor in the Senate. That's assuming, of course, that all Democrats vote the same way. Forget that. But you know, I think he's got some momentum going. There's no question about it. I believe I'm going to get on my little box for a second. This Prop 30, which, by the way, he gets nothing but credit for. He did it on his shoulders. He did, amazingly. Nobody thought it would pass. And it passed by 11 points. This is quite a statement of his abilities. But the unfortunate thing is that everybody sort of let their guard down. It's got a 7-year life, and unless we get very, very serious about reorganizing our revenue system, at the end of those 7 years, we are going to be up a creek without a paddle and have to be home by 5 o'clock. It's just not going to be good at all. And so my fear is that, and all this did, this Prop 30, was keep us where we are.
Yeah.
47th per in education, 50th in roads. I mean, we can go on and on. Wow. We didn't drop down to, you know, Afghanistan's level. I mean, there's nothing great about this. So he has a lot of work, and whether he and the legislature can do that real tough climb to redesign our revenue network remains to be seen.
Melissa, do you think he has those plans to address those structural problems?
No. Why would he do that? He's a rock star right now. That's unpleasant. And he's like, look, I did my job. I got my dog involved. Like, he gave every bit. He left it all on the field. So, I think he feels like, and maybe much later, again, we all know he's going to run again. He's going to probably win again. And so maybe later in his second term, he would start really thinking about addressing some of these structural issues. But for now, I think he's just really enjoying his position. I think we saw this new legislative class is one of the largest freshman classes we've seen in recent history in this state. And so you've got a lot of people who are in Sacramento who more than usual are sort of wandering around not knowing where to go or where the fax machine is and all that sort of thing. So he's got a group of people who are really malleable, I think, and who he can try to offer maybe some protection to or create relationships with and that he can, you know, manipulate, for lack of a better word, for his own ends. And I think that gives him a lot of power in addition to this two-thirds, which, again, you know, it depends on the day. In addition to that, he's got this new group of youngins that he can maybe get his hands around. So I think he's going to be doing great for the next couple of years. And you're right, we do need serious structural reform. But are we going to get it? No, we're going to get little bites of, you know, you can more easily pass a parcel tax, and we're going to, you know, bite away at that little bit of Prop 13. But in terms of really shifting from an income-based revenue stream, which is why we're so all over the place.
Right, up and down.
I don't think that he would do that not during this term.
Okay, Carly, last word on Governor Brown.
I mean, Jerry's a man of surprise. I would absolutely see Melissa's scenario playing out, but I could also see him, you know, locking himself in a war room overnight with his wife and his dog and coming up with, you know, across the board solutions for everything the next day. I mean, you just never know with him. I have read that it's a major priority to kind of revamp education equality, kind of
yes.
put more into, you know, inner city schools, underfunded schools, which is angering, you know, the parents out in Marin who don't want to see their, you know, lovely suburban schools get the axe. I know that he's going to be going after high-speed rail, but again, I think that as to Melissa's point, he's really kind of enjoying being the first person in, the first leader in decades, I believe, to be able to stand up and say, yep, their California budget's fine. We don't, you know, there's no dire situations.
I was talking to Willie Brown the other day, and he said that, so there's, you know, so for what it's worth, he said that Jerry Brown is planning to run for president. He's a joker. But he said it with a serious face, and I was like, okay. So that's another, you know, to your point about him being unpredictable, he may just ride this whole icon.
Oldest president in history.
But he's still.
I do have an original Jerry Brown jacket from his 1992 presidential campaign that I have yet to find an opportunity to wear, but I love it. He was so revolutionary for introducing dial-in voting, or dial in something. There's a big phone number on the back, and people are really excited. It's like the future, and it's kind of funny to see how far that's come.
What's the look on his face if someone refers to him as Governor Moonbeam? Does he smile?
He's just over it. Does he ever smile? I don't think he ever smiles, per se, but I don't think he loves that nickname.
He doesn't know how to smile. There's no way for it to go up.
Okay, we've got some great questions here, so let's try to get through a number of these. So, is prostitution in the same league as gay marriage and medical marijuana? Is that something we might see increasing pressure to legalize?
That's a good
Texas.
One.
That's a really good one.
That's a good one, because you can see both sides of that argument real fast. I mean, you know, again, getting rid of, you know, pimps and crime and all that stuff and legalizing what apparently is, I say apparently, believe me, done, you know, with regularity all over the place. And then talk to some of these women's groups mm-hmm. who really believe fervently that, you know, as long as it is permitted, you know, a woman is submissive and really not equal to a man. And I see both sides of that one. Mm-hmm. I can see where both sides are going to charge at each other. Really.
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely. I don't think that issue has as much political capital as say gay marriage or even, you know, marijuana legalization, especially if we're still fighting over abortion rights. I just don't see Republicans taking up prostitution as something they could stare in the face as a serious, you know, issue that needs reform. Maybe in places like San Francisco, I mean, progressive havens like that. And didn't we pass protection? Did that measure pass? It failed. I voted for it.
So you didn't pass it. Well, actually, I think the opposite is true. I think it's at least for now, and who knows what's going to happen, you know, 100 years from now, but at least for now, I mean, we saw in this last ballot, right, we saw when you want to get name recognition, when you want to run for Secretary of State in a few years, you put something on the ballot that says stop trafficking, protect women and children from forced prostitution. There was no opposition. How would you, right? I think it still remains actually something, a button that people can push. And not to say it's not a good thing to crack down on sex trafficking. I'm not saying that's, but it could have been a law. It could have gone through the state legislature and
right.
easily passed. But no, it was a ballot measure because this guy wanted to get recognition. So,
I think I rewrote history in my head and,
no, that passed. Like,
oh, it
by,
did
like,
pass.
Oh,
that?
Yeah, by huge, huge numbers.
Right.
And so actually, I think on the contrary, it is still seen as something a bit more sacred, actually.
Okay. Whip Kevin McCarthy was quoted as saying the Republican Party has hit bottom in California. Do you think they have? And excuse me. If so, how can they dig themselves out anytime soon, Melissa?
Oh boy. Well, I have to say, the reason I went to Sacramento was because I wanted to see what the party was feeling. Are they going to say, we just need to repackage the same old stuff? Or are they really doing some soul searching? And I will tell you that it seemed from what they were saying, who knows what people are going to do, but from what they were saying, there was a lot of, we're going to repackage. The problem is we're not having conversations with our neighbors. The problem is Democrats are better at Facebook. The problem is they have these databases. Obama has databases, I swear. There was a lot of, we need to reach out. We need to, you know, the problem is the messaging. The problem is our ground game sucks. And so until they get to the point, I think, where they're talking more substantively, and again, like I said, there are some people who tried to have that conversation, but they were not received by the masses very well. As long as, you know, until I think they're willing to have that kind of substantive conversation, it's not the package, right? It's what's in it. We know we got it. Like, it's not unclear what you're selling. I think James Carville, he's awesome, was like, you can't make a dog eat crappy dog food, you know? And it was just like, okay, I kind of understood what he was saying there. Like, we don't like the taste of it? I don't know. But so there seems to be, right now, a real, again, at least stated, lack of effort to turn inward and really look at the principles and not at the packaging. And so until that day comes, I don't know if we've hit bottom.
Larry?
They're gonna do well in 2014. Mm-hmm. They're gonna hold the House because of the way the districts are gerrymandered. Mm-hmm. And that's going to give them a false sense of hope. Then they're gonna get drubbed in 2016 when you have a different turnout, unless they've changed enough laws in enough states, and you know, which I don't think will happen. And after 2016 is when I think they're going to really begin to have a come home to Jesus moment, you know, a big tent. Because I don't think they still get it. I wish they did, because I think, you know, two parties battling it out makes a lot more sense to me than one party dominating the other so badly. But I don't think they get it yet.
Along the lines of what Melissa was saying, one of our audience members wrote, please comment on the Fox interview with Mr. and Mrs. Romney. Mrs. Romney blamed the media for her husband's loss. Caller? You're the media. Defend it.
I definitely took issue with our Viva Obama splash that went up on the homepage after, after the election was called. But no, I mean, I think that there's a lot to, you know, talk about when it comes to the Romney campaign, mm-hmm. but I think one of the biggest issues was just the inability to create a solid platform on anything, and that's as much, I mean, the media reports on what he says, and he said many conflicting things, and so, I mean, sure, he didn't look so great often, but I wouldn't say that that's...
Certainly one of the things he'll be remembered for is the 47%. Video, and then he came out and said, no, that was wrong. I didn't, you know, I shouldn't have said that. That was, I don't believe that. And then after the election, basically he said, yeah, believe it. And he's stuck by that. So I think we finally got him to take a stand on that at least. Okay, so someone's asking, I guess, for some clarification on the sequester. The sequester it's not just for the remainder of this fiscal year. Okay. The $85 billion is this fiscal year. But is this kicking in the whole, what is it, $1.2 trillion?
Correct.
Dollars that they want to cut over 10 years?
I think it's 1-1. It could be 1-2.
Okay.
What's a hot
yeah, what's
billion among friends? But it's over 10 years. Now, it doesn't have to be if they come up with a sort of the grand bargain. They can you know, reverse it. But here's one little fact about this $85 billion. Remember, that has to be done between now and the end of the fiscal year. So you're talking about 2.3% of the budget being cut. It really is 4.6, if you think about it, for the rest of the year. And that's where a lot of people are going to be hurt. Unfortunately, you know, on the military side, okay, there might be some screaming. But on the domestic side, who's going to be hurt? The poor kids are going to be hurt. You know, teachers are going to be hurt. I mean, you know, lots of groups that are not particularly efficacious. And don't get the word out, and don't scream enough, and things like that. So I think that's the long-term thing we've been talking about. You know, we'll talk about this in September, and by that time you may see a lot of people who are not feeling so good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to stick with you with the last question, Larry, because the question is, since your book is called Not So Golden After All, do you see any positive trends in California?
I should have left.
What would you tell Jerry Brown if, for example, he called you up for some happy news?
Do I see some positive trends in California? Well, I see the economy coming back. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing, but that's independent of anything We have work to do, and unfortunately, people tend to ignore the hard lifting that has to be done. And I think Proposition 25, I think it was, that was passed, which allows the legislature to make a budget with a majority vote. Okay, yes, that was good, but to remember, it takes that absolute two-thirds vote to raise the revenues that you need for the budget. Well, what good is it if you have a majority vote when you have nothing to give? So I think we have a lot of work to do, and my job, I guess, as a researcher is to say what's wrong, and I'm sorry, don't blame it on me, but there are things we can do, and we can get serious about dividing. 62% of the state's general fund comes from the income tax. I mean, progressive taxes are great, but just, come on. Only oil-producing state that doesn't tax oil out of the ground? Excuse me? Only one? I mean, when we have to take a backseat to Alaska and Texas? Ouch. Okay. So there's so many things we can do. And I'm kind of hoping we get to the point where people say more of the same is not good enough. And that's where I'm optimistic.
Well, I take comfort from your previous comment that we're still better than Afghanistan.
Yeah. So.
Melissa Carley? Optimistic about our state?
I love California. I was going to say, okay, yes, this is all very sad, but let's go for a nice hike and look at the redwood trees.
Now that's a California. Melissa?
I'm heartened by the new districts that we have and the jungle primary system that we have. I think over time, it's not going to be immediate, but I think over time we'll see some more reasonable, more moderate discourse on both sides. So I'm very hopeful for that. And, there's always Napa.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly
can't be that bad.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you. We are now going to do our quick news quiz. So I need two contestants, and I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to bring you each up here. I'll ask you each five questions. You will be able to get audience help on one of your questions. Not all of them, because our audience is too smart, so they'd get you them all.
That's like call a friend, right?
Kind of, yes, except it's just call out to a friend. So do we have – oh, and, of course, you get the – $2.50, Chuck. So do we have a couple contestants, people who'd like to come up here? You, sir, come up.
I
saw his hand first, sorry. Yes, come on up.
Jacket off.
Your name, TJ?
Yep.
TJ and Michael?
Michael.
Okay.
Shirt's off.
Sorry. And by totally random guessing, I'm going to put TJ, we're going to go first. I'm going to ask you five questions.
Are you the same questions?
No. Okay, question number one. Roman Catholic cardinals are gathering in Rome to do what?
Pick a new pope.
You got it. They're not all hard. Starting tomorrow, this is question number two. Starting tomorrow, which Bay Area bridge is going to be the site of a massive light sculpture that will last 2 years?
San Francisco span of the Bay Bridge.
Correct.
Very specific.
Number three, Google is getting ready to release its internet-enabled eyeglasses. Meanwhile, Apple is due to release its own unique internet-enabled device. What is it?
Is it the iWatch?
Oh, man, I thought you wouldn't get that one. Okay. Doctors announced that a baby girl was surprisingly cured of what?
HIV.
Okay, stop reading the news. Okay, your fifth question. We have a tiebreaker, by the way, if they both get them all. What country's prime minister recently called Zionism, quote, a crime against humanity, unquote, like anti-Semitism or fascism?
Erdogan of Turkey.
Okay, wow. That's five right, folks. Yes. Okay, Michael, you've been in training. Okay, former NBA player and all-around oddity, Dennis Rodman visited what country and met with its leaders?
North Korea.
That's correct. Number two, Vice President Joe Biden said President Barack Obama is not bluffing about stopping whom from getting a nuclear weapon?
Iran.
Correct. Number three, what well-known Briton was hospitalized over the weekend for gastroenteritis?
The Queen?
That's correct. That's correct.
I didn't hear that.
Okay. A liberal Kentucky group got into hot water when it accused who of selling out to China because his wife is of Chinese ancestry?
Mitch McConnell.
Very good. Oh. You guys are too smart. Okay, your fifth question. The U.S. Supreme Court last week heard arguments about the constitutionality of what landmark civil rights law?
Defense of Marriage Act?
Nope. Sorry.
What was it?
Good, I'm sorry. Yes. The Voting Rights Act.
It's yes. Always Voting Rights Act, but yeah. I didn't hear about this one.
Yep. And I believe they heard arguments on both sides of that and lots of fun articles trying to determine what, how they're going to vote on it. Well, you are the winner. You win the bottle. Let me read the tiebreaker just for the record. Scientists say they have finally concluded what caused the Hindenburg disaster. Does anyone know?
Static electricity. Static electricity.
Very good.
Static electricity.
Yes. Thank you, folks. That's our... excuse me. That's our... Static electricity caused the Hindenburg... Don't forget to join us for our next evening program, Monday, April 15th, right here at the Commonwealth Club, and check out our weekly news quiz on Huffington Post San Francisco. Thanks to our panel, Carly Schwartz, Larry Gersten, and Melissa Griffin. Thank you all, and have a great week.